This is Dr. Richard Verone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Bill Hancock. Today is July 21st, 2003, and it's 9:04 a.m. Central Standard Time. And I'm in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library interview room, and Mr. Hancock is in Hamilton, Ohio. Sir, why don't we pick up where we left off? We're getting into May 1967, and talking about Operation Hickory. Can you tell me kind of what the premise of the operation was and what you understood the objectives of the operation to be?
The first thing I knew about it was they came and got us, and I'm not exactly sure where we were. We were somewhere outside Subai, Camp Evans, or somewhere like that.
Right.
And they came and got us, and they loaded us on trucks.
Okay.
On 6x trucks.
Did you guys know that when they came and picked you up on trucks, you were in for something? Was that typical? Or?
No, we didn't know. We didn't know at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that they loaded us on. We got on the trucks, and then our staff officer, Sergeant O'Keefe, then as we were heading north, he mm-hmm. kind of told us a little bit about what we were getting into and stuff. But
do you remember what he kind of told you?
Well, he just told me, since I had only been in the country about 2 months at the time, his exact words to me, he said, "Son, you're going into a different kind of war now."
How did you feel when you heard that?
Well, I was a little apprehensive, of course, because, mm-hmm. and the rest of the people who had been up north before, everybody was kind of quiet, because
mm-hmm.
they kind of knew, when you went up north, you fought the NVA, and you were right on their doorstep, so
mm-hmm.
you knew it wasn't going to be good.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of how it started.
Okay, so you all got on trucks, and how many companies were moved up? Do you know?
I'm not sure. I know our whole company went.
Okay.
Which was kind of unusual. Before, we hadn't really operated as a company.
Mm-hmm.
We had, you know, operated as platoons or squads or something like that, but very seldom were we in the same place with the whole company.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most, because when we were dealing with the VC, most of the units were small units, and so we scattered out in platoon sizes mostly.
Right, right. Okay. So how long did it take you to get where you're going, and where was your objective, actually? Where were you going?
I guess it took us a few hours. I'm not really sure of the time.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it took us a few hours.
Mm-hmm.
And we weren't sure where we were going, but when they did, it took us up Highway 1 and then went across Highway 9 to Camp Low,
mm-hmm.
or at least I'm sure it was Camp Low, and that's where we got off the trucks.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what happened from there?
From there, we started walking north, and, you know, it was just, it was real hot, extremely hot, real dusty.
Mm-hmm.
And we just started up this dirt road and staggered column of twos heading north.
Mm-hmm.
And, at that time, nothing really happened, you know, the first day
right.
that we were out. But, you know, we went through this place outside Camp Low, which I don't know if it was a real name, but they called it Seven Gates to Hell,
mm-hmm.
which it turned out to be as far as I was concerned. But I don't know if that was a real name for the place or not.
Did they say that as you were passing it, going through it?
Yeah.
Okay.
And, we just kept heading north until, I'm not sure exactly which day it was, second or third day.
Mm-hmm.
And we came up to a unit that had been heavily hit.
Mm-hmm.
And we went up there to help them set up a perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
And as we walked into their perimeter, along the road, as we walked in, there were 17 dead Marines covered up.
Really?
Right next to the road.
Hmm.
And so we knew it was going to be bad.
Mm-hmm.
But, we set up a perimeter around them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure what unit it was, but we set up around them to help them, you know, keep out. And, I mean, you could hear gunfire all over the place at this time.
I mean, so it was already started. I mean,
yeah, it was. I mean, other units were getting, not with our units, but other units were getting hit
mm-hmm.
around the area and stuff. So there
mm-hmm.
were other units there. We knew that.
Right.
But they. You could hear heavy gunfire going on. They weren't shooting at us at the time, and
Did you converse at all with the men, the unit that you kind of helped set up the perimeter? Did you talk with them at all?
No, we didn't get to because they rushed us right out to set us up for a perimeter in case they got hit again.
Okay.
So we never really got to talk to any other, we didn't. Maybe our officers and staff and stuff did. I'm sure they did.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as us, no, they just rushed us out to get us on the perimeter.
Can you describe, Bill, what you mean for people listening to this about setting up the perimeter? How would you guys go about actually setting up the perimeter,
well,
especially in a situation like that where there's gunfire going on?
Well, our platoon sergeants and squad leaders and stuff,
mm-hmm.
they would assign us to an area, and we would go out there, dig fighting holes in two-man positions.
Mm-hmm.
About our positions were probably at that time, because it was like dry rice paddies, dried out rice paddies and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the position that we were put in was probably 20 yards either way from the next position.
Okay.
But yeah, it was all two-man positions, you know, and fighting,
mm-hmm.
digging in fighting holes and stuff, and just setting up and sitting there waiting to see if we get attacked or whatever.
How deep is a fighting hole?
Would
you estimate?
Try to dig it, you know, 3 to 4 feet deep.
Mm-hmm.
And but the ground was so hard, we didn't really get to do that quickly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's just something to get you underground.
Right.
You're not exposed.
Were you in an open kind of rice paddy area, or was this?
My position was in a wide open area. We were right in the middle of a dried out rice paddy, so there was no protection.
Okay.
You know, no foliage, no nothing.
Right.
Now, on either side of us, maybe 20, 30 yards away,
mm-hmm.
there were tree lines
mm-hmm.
and things, but as far as where we were at, it was just wide open. It was like being on a pool table or something.
How long did you stay there until anything happened?
Well, we were there for a couple hours, and so I walked over to where John Jones was at. He had set up the machine gun in position next to us,
mm-hmm.
and we were going to eat chow, and while the other guy was on watch, I walked over, and him and I sat along the embankment this tree line was on,
mm-hmm.
and we were just sitting there eating chow and bullcrap, and then he got shot by a sniper.
Really? Where was he hit?
In the leg, in the knee.
Okay. And how did you react to that?
Well, I really, you know, at first, because I was like on the outside towards
mm-hmm.
where the NVA would be, you know, on
mm-hmm.
the outside of perimeter. He was inside of me. So at first I just heard this crack go by me.
Right.
And it just didn't register, you know, exactly what it was for
mm-hmm.
a second.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I mean, I knew it was a shot, but I didn't know what had happened.
Mm-hmm.
And when I turned around, I just saw this red spray and saw him rolling away.
Right.
And so I grabbed him real quick and drug him back to the position. Well, the corpsmen were there immediately. I don't know where the hell they came from or how the hell they knew he was hit.
Mm-hmm.
But, drug him, you know, back to where his position was, and the corpsmen came and started taking care of him, so I scurried over to where my position was again because, you know, the guy was left in there by himself in my position.
Right.
Which wasn't that far away. It took seconds
right.
to get there, but, you know, we wanted to make sure that everything was secure. And the corpsman took care of Jonesy and got him back to the center of the perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just, nothing else happened after that.
You just sat. What do you do when you sit there and pass the time?
Just looking out to see if we can catch any movement out there or any, you know, anything odd. That's anything that looks out of place.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, trying to see them before they want you to.
Okay. And so what happened the rest of the day?
Well, the rest of the day was kind of quiet. We kept, back inside the perimeter, they were trying to bring in helicopters to take out the dead that had been laying there
mm-hmm.
and all the wounded, but they couldn't bring them in because every time they brought them in, the North Vietnamese just kept opening up on the helicopters and it was too dangerous for the choppers to come in.
And could you tell where the fire was coming from?
It was the other side of the perimeter. It was towards the other side of the perimeter. Mm-hmm. It wasn't on our side, so mm-hmm. I really didn't know. I could just hear them opening up, and mm-hmm. you know, you could hear the AK-47s going off and stuff.
In that situation, would part of, I guess, would the company commander say, let's take X amount of men and let's go after those guys in the...
No, not in that situation, because you didn't know how big of a unit was out there.
Right.
And so, yeah, we just basically held our perimeter.
Okay.
In that. Yeah, you wouldn't go after them because... The NVA operated in large units. I mean, they could be, you know, you could have a regiment out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, we wouldn't go after them at that point.
Okay. So you couldn't get the birds in to get the men out?
No.
All right.
So it was getting, you know, it was getting towards evening already.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know if they got a helicopter in there to get the wounded or whatever out, but they didn't get the dead out from that other unit.
Okay.
So... that evening, behind our position, as it got dark,
mm-hmm.
they brought in four entoses in that dried-out rice paddy, just about maybe 40, 50 yards behind us.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe what an entose is for those?
An entose is like a small tank,
mm-hmm.
and it's got six 106-millimeter recoilless rifles on it.
Okay.
And that's a lot of firepower.
Mm-hmm.
And... yeah, they brought four of them up, lined them up behind our hole, which we thought was great. And the other guy was in the hole with me. I'm not sure what his name was, but we're thinking, well, hell, this is nice. You know, we got all this firepower behind us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people aren't... We didn't figure anybody would be messing with us a lot, but we were wrong. So they brought these entoses in while it got dark.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was, of course... You were always on 100% watch until midnight.
Okay.
Everybody awake.
Mm-hmm.
So him and I are sitting in the sitting in our fighting hole, and we're just like sitting up on the edge of it. It was dark. Sitting on the edge of our fighting hole,
mm-hmm.
waiting to, you know, watching out and stuff. And
how much could you see?
You could see maybe 100 yards in the open.
Uh-huh.
But as we're sitting there, you know, we started hearing these mortars dropping tubes. We thought they were ours.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden, you know, we heard the whistling coming in and, you know, started yelling incoming and things like that. Every, of course, other people up and down the line were doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But they just plastered the... They were trying to hit them montoses that were behind us.
Right.
And they just plastered us. I couldn't tell you how many, how much, but they just... And all these guys in the entoses were getting hit. They must have been laying outside the entoses on the ground or
mm-hmm.
no one around outside the entoses, and they started all getting hit and started screaming and calling for the corpsmen and stuff. And they shelled us for, they mortared us for a while. I couldn't tell you how long, but it seemed like an eternity to me.
Mm-hmm.
And
what did you do during this time? Just basically get in your hole and cover up?
Basically get down, you mm-hmm. know, and wait till... You know, wait till it lifted a little bit,
mm-hmm.
firing stopped. Well, what they did was, after they hit these entoses for a while, they started walking them down the line,
mm-hmm.
walking the mortars down the company perimeter. And so we got up, you know, because usually, or a lot of times, following a large mortar attack like that, there'll be a ground assault.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the mortars are to get everybody's head down, and then... troops come in.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were watching for a ground assault. Well, it never came. But the corpsmen back there were just running through the mortar barrage, I mean, while it was going on, mm-hmm. to get to these Amtrak guys, try to take care of them.
Right.
And so me and the other guy were just kind of watching out and sitting there. Well, I don't know. After they walked the mortars down, they walked them back up the lines to us again,
mm-hmm.
and just mortared the hell out of us again, trying to hit those entoses.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, I guess I don't know if they spotted them or whatever, but our mortars and artillery and stuff started shooting back, and it finally ended. They had shot over 300 rounds at us.
Wow.
And so it. And there had been a bunch of guys hit.
Mm-hmm.
And so they, I guess, hauled the wounded back inside the middle of the perimeter. Of course, they couldn't get them out because they still couldn't get helicopters in there.
Mm-hmm.
And me and the other guy, we knew a ground attack was going to come, but it never did.
Mm-hmm.
So we just stood watch the rest of the night.
Did anybody get any sleep?
No. Well, as a matter of fact, so many people have been hit that they moved it to make the perimeter smaller.
Okay.
And so the next morning, when everybody got up and that, nothing else happened that night.
Mm-hmm.
But me and this other guy got up, and we looked outside our hole, and within 6 feet of our hole, six mortar rounds hit.
Six?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I mean, you know, him and I had been laying in the bottom of the hole, and he was Catholic, so he started saying Hail Marys and stuff, and hell, I was saying Hail Marys and things, and I didn't even, I wasn't Catholic.
Something must have happened, though.
Yeah, it was.
That was close.
Well, they were so close that, I mean, when they'd hit, they'd just bounce you.
Mm-hmm.
And the concussion and the dirt coming down on you, all the stuff, everything we had left outside, our packs and stuff that had been outside the hole, were just ripped to shreds.
Mm.
And so that's how the first bad night of Hickory started.
Right. What were operations like the next day? Did you stay in the perimeter? Did you go out and patrol?
The next day what happened was, since they couldn't get all these people out because they couldn't bring helicopters in, we stayed there for a while, and they brought tanks in to take the wounded and dead out on.
Mm-hmm.
And so they come and got me and a couple of the other guys to load the dead and wounded on the tanks to get them taken out.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got to load... me and Ron Marmon got the one with Jonesy on the tank.
Mm-hmm.
And then we took some of the dead guys and stacked them around him so he wouldn't get hit again if the tanks got hit on the way out.
What was that like, stacking the dead?
It was, I don't know how you'd say it. It was just kind of odd, bad feeling, but...
Mm-hmm.
We didn't want Jonesy to get hit again.
Right.
So we did that, and the tanks took them out. And then, I guess later on that afternoon, we moved out on up the same road that we had been going up when we got there.
Uh-huh.
And
well, again, what size unit are you in now? Are you still company
size? Still
our
company, yeah.
Okay.
And as we moved out, when we started up the road, apparently, during the night, a position that was along the road had killed a North Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
I guess a scout or whatever that had attempted to try to cross the road.
Mm-hmm.
And so I saw my first North Vietnamese laying there.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, man, because he had the same kind of equipment that we did.
Really?
I mean, flak jacket, boots, web gear, helmet, you know, all the same kind. I thought, oh, man. This don't look good.
did you think that at this point that they were less well equipped and had, you know, less
up to that point? I didn't really know what to expect.
Right.
All the stuff that this guy had on was brand new.
Okay.
I mean, this wasn't like some of the gear and stuff he found with the VC and stuff. This was all brand new stuff, brand new AK-47s, all brand new clothing and everything else.
Right.
Poncho liners, same kind of stuff we had.
Mm-hmm. So you knew you were up against a well-outfitted unit.
Yeah, this was a trained unit. This wasn't like the VC.
Mm-hmm. So you proceeded north on this road?
We proceeded north. Mm-hmm. There were a few other incidents that happened along our march still going north.
Mm-hmm.
We were in line following an Amtrak was there,
okay.
I think it was. It was, you know, we had tanks and everything with us. But an Amtrak was on the road in front of us, and it hit, and I'm not sure how long after this. It might have been the next day. I don't even remember.
Mm-hmm.
But the Amtrak ran over a command detonated mine.
Hmm.
Mine. And, I mean, it must have been huge. It, well, killed four guys in the Amtrak, and it killed one of our men who was following it.
Mm-hmm.
And we had other, a couple other small incidents like that, but we didn't run into anything real major yet.
Mm-hmm.
Until then we moved on and we hit Hill 117.
Okay. And how many days into the operation did you reach the hill?
We started on the operation on the 17th of May,
mm-hmm.
and we hit Hill 117 on the 25th.
Okay. All right. So when you did you dig in around the hill, or were you told
no.
basically once you what happened when you got there?
Well, we were just, you know, we were, whenever we went up one of those hills, we were usually, if possible, they would put us on line.
Okay.
You know, and so we started up the hills.
How big was the line? Can you describe that?
Oh, I thought, well, you couldn't tell.
Okay.
You know, and it might have just been our unit, you know, a couple guys wide, but if the jungle was thick someplace else,
mm-hmm.
you know, you wouldn't. And it wasn't really jungle. It was brush and stuff, but
mm-hmm.
depending on how well the terrain was, you had to adapt to how you did things.
Mm-hmm.
But we started up the hill and just, like we would go up anyway. We had done that, you know, 100 times before.
Right.
And, but this time we ran into a battalion-sized bunker complex of the NVA.
Mm. Mm.
And it, when the point men and that got right up on it, it just opened up. And it was like the end of the world started.
Mm-hmm. What, can you describe the action, what happened, what that kind of combat is like?
Well, it's, you know, Battalion NVA is probably, we probably by that time had maybe 130 guys in hotel company left.
Mm-hmm.
We probably started out the operation with 150.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and we walked into a battalion size, which is probably 450 NVA.
Mm-hmm.
And when they all open up at one time, it's just deafening.
Yeah.
Could
you see them, or were they in the bunkers?
No, we couldn't. All we could see was the muzzle flashes and stuff like that. They were all in bunkers.
Right.
And fighting holes and, you know, spider traps and all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a well-organized unit.
Did you immediately see cover, or is it something where you just...
You just get down and try to find the best cover you can find at the second, because you can't move around.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's my dog barking at the thunder. And I mean, this fire was just so intense. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've told people I felt like there were so many bullets coming over you could actually feel the heat.
Really?
You know, and of course they started throwing grenades and shooting mortars at us and RPG rockets and everything else, because it was a whole well-organized battalion.
Right. How did you all counter that?
We just tried to put out as much fire as we could, which was kind of, we had so many guys hit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think on the, we were just trying to suppress their fire as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all the guys that were hit are yelling for corpsmen, and it's so smoky and stuff you can't hardly see.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't hear hardly anything because the noise is just so loud.
Mm-hmm.
And you feel like you're alone.
Really?
When you're in something like that, because it's just so intense, at a time you feel like you're the only person out there.
Right.
At times.
Right.
But you know, and this, I don't know how long this went on for. I couldn't really tell you. I'm sure if we look at the after action report, it'll tell you in there, but it just seemed like forever to me.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, there's so many rounds coming over that the trees and brush that were around me,
mm-hmm.
it just kept, all the branches and stuff just kept falling on me. I was getting, like, covered up.
Oh, yeah?
I had to, like, dig my way out in order to fire.
Hmm. Did you have an M16?
Yes.
Okay.
And, so, you know, it went on for quite a while, and just shooting it on the muzzle flashes. We couldn't call in artillery at first because they were too close.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just combat from 20 feet apart.
Could you tell if you had hit anything, or you were just firing at random to try to, wherever you
saw
a muzzle flash?
We were firing at the muzzle flashes, you know, because they had bunkers, covered bunkers, and, you know, and, I mean, you could see the muzzle flashes coming from the bunkers, because you really couldn't, the bunkers were so well concealed, you couldn't see the bunkers hardly.
Okay.
I mean, you couldn't, we didn't even know they were there. The point man walked almost right up on them before they opened up.
Gosh. Did you have grenades that you could have used?
We used grenades. We used everything that we could use.
Uh-huh. Right.
But
were you eventually able to call in some artillery?
Well, eventually, you know, I mean, I don't know how long it was, but either they were started because we had gotten down and everything, and at that time you're going to get less casualties than that. But the fire started easing up.
Mm-hmm.
Which it might have been an hour, might have been an hour and a half, whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
So we got to start bringing the dead and wounded down off the hill. And, you know, so we pulled back, brought everybody off the hill.
Mm-hmm.
They brought up the tanks, you know, to load them again.
Mm-hmm.
And we just, they just hit it with artillery and airstrikes and everything else.
Mm-hmm. I take it you weren't hit.
No, I wasn't hit. I didn't get hit during Hickory.
Okay.
But, you know, then later on, they sent us back up the hill again. They brought in a company from 4th Marines to assist us. And, you know, they went back up the hill again.
Did you go up?
Yeah. And it was even worse than the first time.
Really?
So this, you know, we lost a bunch of more guys.
Why was it worse the second time after the artillery fire and the air fire?
I'm not sure. But it was, I think there were, you know, first time we had something like 32 guys hit out of our company.
Mm-hmm.
Second time up it was a bunch more.
Right. How do you...
These are the estimates I'm giving you, but...
Right, of course. How do you personally, Bill, do you remember how you felt having to go back up the hill? How do you go back up that hill knowing exactly what is up there and what has happened
just,
already?
Because everybody else is going up.
Right.
And you're not going to let them down.
Uh-huh.
So when you get the orders to do that, everybody looks at each other, make sure that... we're all on the same page, and then you just head up again.
Mm-hmm. Any thought about death yourself? Any thought about that at all? Or are you trying to figure out exactly how best you can go about this?
I don't really remember, to tell you the truth.
Okay.
I mean, I was scared. I don't know if I thought about dying or getting just hit or whatever, but scared shitless. But you just go.
Anything happen on that second time up?
Oh, yeah. That's when we took more casualties the second time than the first time.
Okay. Same type of fight?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Were you all successful of taking the hill that time?
No.
Okay.
No. And, I mean, altogether, it lasted most of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And so we ended up just pulling back again, pulling everybody back off the hill again. And then... it was evening then, so all night long they hit that hill with airstrikes, artillery, whatever else they had.
Right.
And so then they went back up again the next day.
Okay, well, so this is the third assault.
Yeah, we went. Well, but the next day, I think the unit from 3-4 got hit some, but we never really, you know, it's. They had pulled out, basically. They just left behind some people to harass you.
Uh-huh.
And so they took the hill the next day.
Okay. Were you on that third assault?
Yeah. Well, it really wasn't an assault.
Okay. Okay. And once you had the hill, what happened?
Stayed there for a while. Said, that's it, and moved out.
So there one of the things about the Vietnam War that people don't understand or have a difficulty understanding is you're taking territory, then you're relinquishing territory.
Oh, yeah. We left it that, you know, I don't know if the other units stayed or not, and I'm sure they didn't. It wasn't a very important hill.
Right. It was just the hill there that you guys were headed toward, and you wanted to get past it and move forward.
Yeah. And so then for the next, as a matter of fact, after that day, they changed the name of the operation, which we didn't know at the time, but I found out later on. And but we, I guess, most of the NVA that had been in the area, because there had been several other big fights in the area, the NVA, I guess, pulled back across the DMZ into North Vietnam. And so we swept up there for another week or 2 weeks or whatever it was, and didn't really run into anything.
Okay.
Some snipers or something like that, but nothing much.
What was Hotel Company's strength at this point?
27 men.
Wow. Out of what, 120, 130?
I think it was around, I'm going to say 150 to start off with.
Okay. That's incredible.
So they brought in helicopters and flew us back to Dong Ha. And at Dong Ha, they had this Air Force EM club. I'll never forget this.
Okay.
Kind of a funny story anyway.
Uh-huh.
But it was surrounded by like a chain link fence. And so we wanted to go in and get a couple beers. You got a ration card. You were allowed 2 beers a day.
Right.
So we all wanted to go in and get some beers. Well, they told us we weren't allowed to go in.
Okay. Was this an officer's club or just a regular
club? No, just a regular club.
Okay.
So they weren't going to let us go in.
Okay.
And I don't remember, one of the officers or staff that finally told the guy there, he said, if you don't let us in, ain't nobody going to be using this club ever again. So they finally decided to let us in 2 at a time.
Okay.
They let 2 guys go in at a time and get 2 beers each.
Okay.
And then come back out. But I walked in this club, which was just 11 miles from the DMZ. 11 miles from where we had hit 117, because 117 was right on the southern border of the DMZ, right on it.
Okay.
And so they, you know, like I said, I walked in this club, and it's a little bit dark. Well, they got a full bar with every kind of booze you could possibly think of, slot machines. They got a stage where bands come up there and play for them, and all this stuff, and I'm thinking, I'm in the wrong place.
This is an Air Force enlisted man's club, right?
Yeah.
Okay. It's a huge contrast of what you guys have just been through.
Oh, yeah. They got live music and everything.
Uh-huh.
So, anyway, we went back out. Like I said, it was so hot. It was just terrible.
Uh-huh.
Terrible hot. But
how'd you deal with the heat, Bill? What did you do?
Well, I remember when you interviewed Jonesy, he'll tell you the same story. One day we was out on Hickory, and we were following the tanks. And, I mean, we had run out of water. It must have been 115 degrees. You know, we're walking around carrying 80 pounds of gear and all this stuff. And so this tank ran. We couldn't find any water. And this tank ran through this little mud puddle, which I don't know where it came from. And me and Jones are sitting there, and we said, I'm getting some water. So we drank out of a damn mud puddle.
Are you serious?
Oh, no.
You got that on your hands and knees?
Well, we dipped our canteens in. After we was drinking, we could feel all the grit and stuff in our teeth.
I guess it worked there for the moment, though.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, then we got up, and we walked a couple hundred yards up, and we ran across this perfectly clear stream.
Okay.
Where we got to fill our canteens and stuff.
Uh-huh.
That's kind of, it was just that hot.
Right, right.
Well, anyway, after we left Dong Ha, and I'm not sure if they took us back by helicopter or by truck, but they took us back to Phu Bai then.
Okay.
And we got back there, and they had these 16-man general-purpose tents set up for us. Well, we only had, like, 3 or 4 guys in each tent. And so so it was kind of odd. But
right.
We got back and we thought, well, we're going to get a few days rest. Well, that same day, a helicopter got shot down someplace outside of Fubai, so they hauled all us out of the relaxation that we were having, put us back on the choppers and sent us out to protect this helicopter overnight so the BC wouldn't get it.
Uh-huh.
And
so you just set a perimeter around the helicopter?
Yeah, we set a perimeter up around the helicopter, and the next morning then they brought in this big cargo helicopter or whatever it was and hauled it out of there. But they didn't want the BC to get anything out of that helicopter. So.
Right.
But we're thinking, couldn't they get somebody else to do this?
Yeah, really, you'd just come out of combat.
Yeah. Felt it. But the next morning they pulled us back to Fubai for, I don't know, they let us stay in Fubai for 3 or 4 days or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And then since our company was, we were ineffective as a company, naturally.
Right.
So they decided then, until we got replacements and stuff, they put us guarding bridges and stuff along Highway 1.
Okay. And you're talking the 27 out of Hotel Company that's left.
Yeah.
So you're guarding bridges on Highway 1. How long did you do that?
Well, we ended up doing it for, and working out of attack units, running ambushes and patrols
mm-hmm.
and things like that. We ended up doing that for a couple months.
Mm-hmm.
Until they finally got us enough men back in our company where we could be operational again.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe some of those operations? You said running ambushes and things of the sort. What would you do?
Well, during the day we'd run patrols out of these places,
uh-huh.
just looking for any signs of, down in that area is more VC.
Uh-huh.
So we were looking, for any signs of VC, trying to find any VC units we could.
Mm-hmm.
Rice storage, weapons caches.
Right. So you'd go into villages and
talk to the villagers
uh-huh.
and a lot of times we would operate with a Chuhoy scout.
Right.
Or something, and they would talk to the villagers and stuff. And
how much did you trust the Chuhoys?
Myself, not very much.
Mm-hmm.
But we'd just look for stuff like that, and then at night when we come back, 2 out of every 3 nights each of us would have to go out on ambush.
Okay.
And so we'd go out at dusk and then set up somewhere along the trail and just wait for some VC to come walking through.
How many men in this unit?
There were usually like 10.
Mm-hmm.
That's counting because they would, the normal squad we had over there would maybe have 7 guys in it, and then they would attach a machine gun section when you went out on ambush,
mm-hmm.
a machine gun team, and
right.
Have 3 guys maybe.
Okay,
so we'd end up with maybe 10.
So a nice reinforced squad.
Yeah.
Okay. And when you would lay an ambush, who picked the trail and
I was picked out for us before we ever went out.
Okay. And how would you set up?
We'd go out along the trail and bust into the brush,
mm-hmm.
move along the trail, and then just lay down on the ground in 2-man teams,
mm-hmm.
maybe 10 yards apart, 8 yards apart, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And just set up like that, and then you'd stay on watch at night. Everybody'd stay awake until midnight,
mm-hmm.
and then after midnight, you'd go 2 hours watch, 2 hours on watch, 2 hours off watch between the 2 guys in the position.
Mm-hmm. How often did you have any action?
I would say on the average, I'm just guessing, this is just an estimate, but
mm-hmm.
I would guess maybe 6-7 times, 8 times a month.
Okay. And I assume that these were kind of short burst firefights. And
yeah, they never lasted more. I would say none of the ambushes I was ever on that was sprung lasted more than a couple of minutes.
Okay.
Because usually when if you caught the VC off guard, they'd just take off.
Right.
They just flat get.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about going into the villages and what your impression was of the Vietnamese civilians.
I loved the kids. Thought they were cuter than hell.
Yeah?
Yeah. And the villagers, they were just farmers trying to get along.
Uh-huh.
They were just trying to make a living. They didn't want the damn war. And they were trying to please both sides because during the day, we controlled everything, and at night the PCs control the villages. You know, they'd go into the villages at night and stuff. So.
Did you realize this at the time, or is this a reflection looking back upon your time?
No, we knew it. We knew it.
How would the villages treat you? How would they? Would they just look at you, or would you try to communicate with them?
Yeah, they were afraid, and I'm sure they were the same way with the VC if you wanted their treat.
Mm-hmm.
But they were afraid because they didn't want to do anything for us,
mm-hmm.
because the VC would find out about it, and you know, they'd be in trouble with them.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to really do anything for the VC that we would find out about,
because
they'd be in trouble with us. So they had it kind of rough.
Right. Tell me about the kids. You said you love them. What would they do?
They were just cute as can be. You know, mostly they just wanted food or cigarettes or attention or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, guys would give them food. Usually didn't give them any cigarettes, because most of them, the ones asking for cigarettes are usually about four.
Gosh. Okay.
And you know, they were just cute. Lots
uh-huh.
of laughs, always smiling.
Uh-huh.
You know, the kids, they had no fear. They didn't they weren't afraid of us or stuff like that. They just knew that we had stuff we could give them.
Right. Right. How often would you find rice stores or weapon stores?
Oh, lots of times.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, especially rice.
What would you do when you found them? And where
you know,
would you...
If you went into a place, you know, if you went into a hut with a villager, and when they grew, when they had their rice, you know, they might have 25 pounds of rice.
Mm-hmm.
You'd go into a hut and find 500 pounds of rice.
Right.
You knew it wasn't for them.
Was it just sitting out in the open, or would they try to hide it?
No, they'd try to hide it.
Okay. How would they hide it?
Oh, they would, you know, they'd dig bunkers and stuff that they would hide it in, and or have it out someplace and just camouflage it.
Mm-hmm. And what would you go do when you did find the rice?
If we found a you know, like I said, an inordinate amount of rice,
mm-hmm.
we destroyed it because that was being stashed for the VC.
Right.
The VC made them do that,
and the villagers understood this, that you needed to destroy the rice.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if they understood that, because it was probably part of their rice was in that too. But
right.
You know, if they were growing it for the VC, we didn't want the VC to have it.
How would you destroy the rice?
They'd just burn it.
Would you take it out of the hooch and?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we didn't burn our huts down.
What about this? It's a stereotype of the Vietnam War that you all would walk into the villages and treat the civilians poorly and burn down this and that. How often did anything remotely like that happen?
We I don't remember really. I'm trying to think, and we might have done that one time
mm-hmm.
in the whole time I was over there, but it was strictly because it was a VC village,
mm-hmm.
and I mean, we had been hitting number, and we didn't burn the whole village. We just burned down a couple of huts.
Right.
But that was only because we had been fired at from them huts a number of times.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just a one-time deal. You know, it was somebody who was a sympathizer for the VC or a whatever.
Right. So
would
you
say we didn't burn down huts? You know.
Right. Would you say that's one of the biggest myths and misconceptions about the war?
Well, I can say that it was for our unit. I don't know how other units were.
Okay.
I can't tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was different in the Marine Corps in a way because we were all enlisted. I mean, you know, we all volunteered.
Right.
We weren't just draftees that they had pulled off the street and threw out there.
Right.
We had a lot of discipline in our units. Our officers and staff were on a whole really good,
mm-hmm.
and so we, being so disciplined and stuff, we just didn't do that kind of thing.
Right. Tell me about the relationship you formed with the other men there in your unit and your relationship with the officers.
Like I said, you know, almost all, I would say 99% of the officers that we had were really good.
Mm-hmm.
And our staff officers, our mm-hmm. staff NCOs were really good.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them have been, a number of them have been in the Korean War before.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had really good leadership. We had really good discipline. And they tried to take care of us.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a pretty good relationship with them.
Okay. How about the men in your unit there, the other enlisted?
Wonderful. Just absolutely wonderful. It's a bond that you just can't imagine.
Mm-hmm.
They're just all great guys.
Mm-hmm.
And you could depend on them. You know, we knew that we never left anybody behind,
mm-hmm.
No matter how bad it got.
Mm-hmm.
No one in our unit was ever left behind. During the time I was there. Now,
mm-hmm.
I can't speak for the whole time, but during the time I was there, no one was ever left behind.
And I imagine that helped you psychologically.
Oh, yeah.
Knowing that you would be taken care of if something happened to you.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, it was just a way of life for us. You knew that you could depend on each other. We became real close.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of traumatic because of that too.
Mm-hmm.
You lost friends, and saw friends get hurt.
How do you deal with that? How did you deal with that?
It usually happens so fast. The tough thing for it was, and you know, they used to always tell each other it doesn't mean anything.
Right.
You know, when somebody get hit, because you just had to go on.
Right.
You didn't get to stop just because that happened.
Right.
And they would get wounded or killed, and the helicopter would be there within 10 minutes, and they were gone, and you never saw them again.
Mm-hmm.
You never, you know, and a lot of them you just never even really knew what happened to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people that were terribly wounded and you thought wouldn't make it ended up being fine later on.
Mm-hmm.
But you just never knew.
Right. Was there a way for you to find out if you wanted to know?
Not really, because a lot of them, when they were terribly wounded like that, they took them right out of the country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'd put them on the hospital ship, repose at a sanctuary, or fly them to Yokosuka, Japan, or something, and send them right back to the States, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you really never heard anything about them. One or two you might, you know, if they didn't leave country right away or something, but
mm-hmm.
other than that, yeah, you just didn't hear about it.
Did that bother you all?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because you always wondered.
And I guess you found out about a lot of these men that you with whom you served much later in life.
35 years later or so.
Yeah?
You know, 30-some years later, you know, when we had our first reunion, you know, walked in and guys that we thought had been dead for all these years ended up at the reunion, so.
Right.
So it was, it was hard to take, but you just had to go on. And
mm-hmm.
You had to put that down, and because, you know, as soon as that medevac helicopter left, you still had a job to do, and you'd go right back out and start again.
Tell me about the medevac, the dust-off guys. What were they like?
We never really saw them, because
mm-hmm.
all we'd see of them was, we would call for them, throw out smoke for them to mark the location for them to bring the helicopters in.
Mm-hmm.
And then as soon as that copter started coming in, you started running over there with the stretchers or, you know, carrying the guys over there. And
mm-hmm.
you throw them on the helicopter as soon as it touches down, and he jumps off. I mean, they don't hang around.
Right.
They're gone.
Right.
You know, then you just pick up everything and all the gear and weapons or anything that might have been left and
mm-hmm.
move on to your next job.
Were you ever wounded, Bill?
Yeah.
Okay, and that came when?
In August of 67.
Okay. We'll talk about that in just a minute. Let me ask a couple of questions. Amongst your unit there in Hotel Company, was there any discussion or incidents of fragging at all?
No.
Okay. Well, do you think that was a much, much lower occurrence with the Marine Corps?
Yes.
Okay.
Simply because in our unit, like I said, we were all volunteers.
Right.
We didn't get drafted.
Mm-hmm.
It was an all-volunteer unit, and it was pretty well disciplined.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was there any noticeable tension between you all who were out in the field and then those in the rear when you would go back, say, to Fubai or to other places?
I wouldn't say tension or anything. I'd say teasing.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Like what?
Just joking, you know, about the hogs in the rear and stuff like that. But it was just teasing and fun and stuff like that. Everybody knew that they had to be back there to do a job, too. You know, there was a job that was being done back there. They had to send out supplies. They had to send out ammunition and water and stuff like that. So it was just, they got the mail, which was probably the most important thing.
Yeah, tell me about that. What kind of contact did you personally have with home?
I would get letters, you know. Well, and a lot of it depended, you know, but I would say on a normal basis, we got letters every few days. You know, now when we got to places like Chicory and stuff like that, it might be a week or 10 days or something, and you wouldn't get mail. But as soon as it was opportune and they could do it, they'd bring you the mail.
They knew that was a big psychological
thing. They knew that was a big psychological thing. So,
yeah.
the first opportunity they would get to bring it, they'd bring it.
How often did you ride home?
I would guess at least once a week. That I rode home, but yeah, I mean, you would save up, you know, and as soon as whenever a resupply helicopter come in, you could throw whatever mail you had, they would gather up and you could throw it on the resupply chopper and they'd take it out. So, you know, almost every day mail went out.
In your letters, would you tell exactly what had happened or did you kind of cushion it for your family?
No, I wouldn't tell them exactly what happened.
Okay.
I wouldn't do that. There wasn't a sense in them worrying about that.
Right. How long would it take your letters to get back to the States?
I really couldn't tell you.
Okay. I did not.
I really could not tell you.
Okay.
I know it took a while sometimes for theirs to get over,
You
know, because you'd get a letter and it'd be from 2 weeks before or a week and a half before or something.
Mm-hmm.
But, I really couldn't tell you how long it'd take for them to get back.
Okay. Were you ever able to make any Mars telephone calls?
After I was wounded.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, they made sure that we did that, as a matter of fact.
Right.
You know, and they took me down to Mars, but that was kind of tough because when you talk, it was like talking on the radio. You'd talk and then you'd have to stay over so the other person could talk. Well, my mom got on there and cried the whole damn time. So it was really tough to talk to her.
Right. Right. Were you able to keep up with news from back in the United States at all?
Some. Very little, but some. You know, they would bring out at certain times when they would bring out the resupply, they'd bring out a couple of Stars and Stripes or something. That's the only news we really got.
Mm-hmm.
Except for Hannah on the radio, you know.
Mm-hmm.
She would give us her version of the news.
Tell me about that. What was that like? What did she say?
Well, she would just tell us that, you know, everybody was against us and, you know, that we were all going to die and, the people's army was going to, you know, run us out and kill us and all kinds of stuff like that. But we just kind of laughed that off because it was propaganda.
You all knew that?
Yeah, we knew that.
Yeah. What would you do for entertainment? I know in the field
joke
that must have been
with each other.
I'm sorry?
We'd joke with each other.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that was our entertainment. You know, we listened to stories from each other about their girlfriends or their life back home before they got there and, you know, stuff like that. Every once in a while, if we'd hit a stream around a secure area, we'd take a swim or that, but mostly it was just talking to each other and keeping each other up.
Right. Was there any significant drug or alcohol use that you witnessed?
No. No, not in our unit. I mean, there was alcohol use, and I'm sure there was some pot smoked or something, but never in the field. Only when we got to a secure area or something. I never saw any of that in the field or when they knew you were going out to the field.
Right.
But, I mean, naturally, when we got back to places like Fubai or Camp Evans or someplace where they had EM clubs, I mean, as soon as you knew you weren't going out in the field, the first thing you did was clean your rifle, clean yourself, and then head straight for the club.
Right.
to get all the beers that you could get.
Mm-hmm.
So,
did you ever get to go to any USO shows?
One USO show the whole time I was over there.
Really?
But it was just some Oriental band that they brought in. And this was at Fubai when we were in the rear.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, it was just like a band that they brought in, Oriental band.
Were they any good?
I thought they were fantastic, but they probably weren't. I mean, you know, it's kind of hard when they're, you know, singing, give me some lovin', and it comes out, give me some rubbin'. But we thought they were fantastic.
Right,
you know,
right.
Anything to take your mind off of things and entertain you was wonderful.
Of course, of course. What about the role music played in your life over there?
We got to listen to a little. If we were in a somewhat secure area,
mm-hmm.
like when we were working at the CAC units or something like that, we would listen to Armed Forces radio.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you'd get to hear some music and stuff, but not very often.
Are there songs that you hear today that take you back to Vietnam?
Oh yeah.
Like,
oh yeah.
Such as?
To Serve with Love.
Mm-hmm.
By Lulu. The Airplane by Jefferson. I guess it was Jefferson Airplane.
Uh-huh.
You know, yeah, there were a few.
Yeah.
We got to get out of this place.
Uh-huh. I hear that often.
Oh yeah.
Right. Bill, let me ask you, did your experience in Vietnam during your time there, looking back on your time, did your religious beliefs change, evolve,
yeah.
begin at all?
Yeah, they changed.
What happened in country?
You don't
have to answer this if you don't want to.
No, I just changed. I no longer go to church or never have since I left there.
Can you explain why?
I don't know. I really can't. I just don't feel like that's the place for me or whatever.
Okay. Okay. Let me ask you about your contact with the indigenous military of South Vietnam, the Arvin. And
yeah.
What was your experience with these guys?
The ones that we worked with, I just didn't think were very good.
Really?
Why not? Well, I mean, most of the time, the only times we were supposed to work with them, they never showed up.
Really?
Yeah.
What was the reasoning?
I have no idea.
So, did you ever actually get to work in the field side by side with them?
No.
Okay.
You know, we saw them around, like when we were along Highway 1,
mm-hmm.
guarding the bridges and working at CAC units and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They were there, but we never really worked with them.
Okay.
And we just didn't think very much of them, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't very professional. The ones that we saw, now there were probably units out there that were.
Mm-hmm.
But the ones that we worked with personally, or were around personally, never really worked with us and just didn't seem very professional.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you have any exposure to Agent Orange that you were aware of?
Yeah.
Did that come later in your tour?
Yeah, it came at Quezon, around Quezon.
Okay.
And when we were up north, a lot of places they would try to knock down the foliage.
Mm-hmm. Did you guys talk about that at the time? Or?
No, we had no idea anything, you know, that it might be hazardous or,
mm-hmm.
you know, nobody even thought about it. We were just, you know, you'd get up, you'd be covered with this white powder and stuff, and nobody really thought about any hazards of that. We were worried about other hazards.
Mm-hmm. Right. Do you think you've suffered anything from that exposure?
I really can't tell you. I got some strange rashes and had a lot of cysts taken out and stuff like that, but I'm not sure if that's the cause or not.
Okay, okay. Were you ever able to take any R&Rs?
Yeah, I took. Got one in-country and one out-of-country R&R.
Okay. When was that? When was your in-country R&R?
I'm trying to think. I'm thinking it was like August of 67,
okay.
maybe.
Was it right after or around the time you were wounded then?
It was right after, I think.
Okay. Where did you go?
China Beach.
Uh-huh. What was it like?
Well, it was, I mean, there wasn't much there, really, if mm-hmm. you wanted the truth, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, they grilled steaks. They had all the beer you wanted to drink. You had a whole beach to be on all day if you wanted, and there was a USO club, and that was about it. It was just a place to get to relax.
Did you go by yourself, or did you have other men with you?
I think there were two other guys with me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was just a place to just get away, and you didn't have to worry about things for a couple of days.
Did that help you?
Yeah, gave you a chance to be relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine I drank too much and ate too much and whatever, but yeah, it was relaxing.
Mm-hmm. How about your out of country R&R?
I went to Japan. Had opportunity to go other places, but I went there, I think it was in June, right after Hickory, not
mm-hmm.
too long after Hickory.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, I took Japan because the only other one I could have took was Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
But the married guys used to go to Hawaii to meet their wives.
Right.
So we would pass up on that so the married guys could get that.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Japan with another. As a matter of fact, it was one of the replacements they sent us up for our unit after Hickory.
Mm-hmm.
So I went on R&R with.
Okay.
But it was great.
Yeah, same
I
kind
did
of
all the wild things that I could possibly do.
Yeah? Do you want to talk about any of it?
No, sure, it don't matter.
Uh-huh. Well, tell me what you all would do.
Well, you know, it was just so relaxing to know that we were going, and like mm-hmm. I said, that was the first time I got a chance to, right after, it was shortly after Hickory,
mm-hmm.
and they had sent up this, the guy I went with had been a shore patrol in Da Nang.
Mm-hmm.
And he hadn't had R&R, so him and I went together. Really didn't know each other because they had just sent him in with the company
right. Shortly
before that. But went over there, and we just had a ball. They gave us all the pay that we had on the books
mm-hmm.
and took it over there and rented the whole floor of this Japanese hotel.
Did you really?
Yeah.
The two of you?
Yeah, we rented all the rooms.
Uh-huh.
And just boozed and chased women and
mm-hmm.
all that stuff for 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
Bought new clothes every day.
Mm-hmm.
We'd have these girls were staying with us. We bought new clothes. We'd wear them that day, throw them off the balcony at night, send the girls out to buy us new ones. Just, you know, had a good old time.
Right. How much did that help you psychologically going back in country, and especially after Hickory?
Well, it was tough going back. It was great being there, but then it was tough going back, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Of course, nobody wanted to go back because they knew what was happening. So.
Right.
But we made it back. We made it back 3 days late, arrested, but we made it back.
You made it back 3 days late?
Yeah, well, when we got back to Da Nang,
uh-huh.
when we left Japan and got back to Da Nang, this guy, like I told you, had been a shore patrol.
Uh-huh.
And he said, well, I got some friends down here. Let's go up and visit them before we head back to the company. Well, it was a CB... fire department in
mm-hmm.
Da Nang. And so we go into this compound that they got like a great big above ground swimming pool in there.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got maids that come in and clean up the rooms for them every day. They're grilling steaks, got all the beer that you could possibly want
mm-hmm.
and stuff. And so he said, this is pretty good.
Yeah.
So we decided to stay for a couple extra days.
And you knew that you would get in trouble, right?
Oh, yeah, no doubt.
But you didn't care.
No. What were they going to do to us?
Send you to Vietnam.
Yeah. I mean, I still had about eight months left, I guess.
Right.
And so we stayed for a couple of days. Well, one night he was going to go out and get some more booze,
mm-hmm.
and it was late at night. And of course, you weren't supposed to be on the streets of Da Nang.
Mm-hmm.
And he left, and he didn't come back for a long time, so I got my weapon and went out. I didn't get no further than maybe 100 yards outside the compound and got picked up by the MPs.
Oh, really?
Which took us back and then took us in front of the provost marshal or whatever he was. And they put us in handcuffs. He was there, too. They put us in handcuffs,
mm-hmm.
put us with a guard, put us on C-130 and flew us back to our company, Fubai. Took us in front of the executive officer of the company,
mm-hmm.
and they started reading off all the charges against us, and I'm thinking, shit, I'm going to Leavenworth,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, I mean, they could have got us for desertion in time of war or whatever the hell it was,
mm-hmm.
but the XOs told the MP that took us back, he said, uncuff them. And the MP said, what are you going to do about this? And he said, well, I'm not going to give them any more R&R. So that was it. And there went our records of nothing.
Oh, that's good.
So we made it back.
Okay. How were the guys when you came back? How'd they treat you?
Oh, great. Everybody wants, of course, everybody wants to hear about what went on
and
stuff like that. That's kind of their entertainment, you know.
Right.
And, oh, it was just wonderful. I mean, I was really a part of the company then.
Right.
I was one of the oldest guys left.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, it was wonderful.
Tell me about when you're out in the field. Did you guys ever stumble upon any interesting wild animals?
Well, lots of snakes.
How would you deal with those?
Give them their leeway.
Yeah? What kind of snakes did you see?
I saw anaconda.
Really?
Saw cobras, bamboo vipers, that kind of stuff. But I mean, I don't know of anyone that ever got bit by a snake while I was there.
Really?
I mean, they were everywhere. We saw them.
But no close calls.
But, well, we had a corpsman that was laying down and had his head on his pack.
Mm-hmm.
And a bamboo viper crawled out, which is very poisonous. They're almost like a coral snake or something like that, small like that.
The two-stepper or three-stepper?
Yeah, I don't know what they call them, but, I mean, it just crawled out from under the pack that he had his head on. But, and, you know, whenever you would lay out at night, if you had a place out there at night, you know, and you were laying it started raining or something, and something, and it used to feel cold at night. Simply to change the temperature, especially when it rained.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you would freeze sometimes at night when it rained.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it was just a big temperature change. It wasn't that it was cold, but the big temperature change made it feel cold.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, everything that wanted to stay warm got up against you.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you had stuff crawling around you all the time and things. And, you know, you didn't move real fast.
Right.
You didn't jump up if you felt something crawling on you, if you didn't want to get bit.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I don't know of anyone that got bit or anything by that. The only thing they got bit by that I know of, we had two guys that were bit by these huge red centipedes that made them sicker than hell.
Really?
Yeah, we, and stuff. But we found, I didn't see any. We saw rock apes and monkeys, actually. And we found tracks from tigers and tracks from elephants, but we never did see any.
Okay.
The rock apes were hilarious.
Really? What'd they do?
Scared the shit out of me, mostly whenever they got the chance. You'd be out on ambush or going out someplace, and they'd just, next thing you know, they'd be standing next to you. You hadn't even heard them or anything.
Oh, my God.
You know, they'd... Well, one time, of course, this was later on a case on, but we had a guy that was walking point for us going down to the water point. This is before the siege actually started.
Mm-hmm.
And the elephant grass was like 8 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
and of course, the point man's out as far as he can be where you can still see him.
Mm-hmm.
And so as he was walking out there, the rock ape reached out and grabbed him.
Oh, God.
Which naturally scared the crap out of him.
Oh, yeah.
And he just took off running.
Back towards you or what?
No, the other way. We had to catch him. But as soon as the rock ape grabbed him, he yelled. The rock ape yelled and took off the other way.
How big were these rock apes?
Like a chimpanzee.
Uh-huh.
They were red. And, yeah, kind of looked like a chimp. But, yeah, that was mostly the wildlife that I saw, you know, mostly snakes. And, of course, leeches were everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You got up every... You know, when you were in the jungle every morning, the first thing you did was get up and get all the damn leeches off of you.
Mm.
Or if you crossed the stream, the water leeches were 20 times bigger than the tree leeches.
These are pretty bad conditions in which you're working.
Oh, yeah.
But you just adapted to it.
Well, everybody was covered with sores and, I mean, cuts and sores. Because when you're in the jungle, everything either cuts you, bites you, or stings you.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, the whole time you're over there, if you're operating in the jungle anywhere, you're covered with sores or immersion foot from being wet all the time and mosquito bites and, you know, everything else.
Mm-hmm.
You've always got some kind of infections and stuff like that.
Was it difficult to stay healthy?
You know, it doesn't really, I don't know if it, it doesn't seem like it was difficult to stay healthy. These things were all just bothersome.
Right.
The only time I can remember when I was sick over there was we had, we were out patrolling and ambushing and stuff, and we had set up a perimeter around the stream,
mm-hmm.
and apparently the VC found an old dead water buffalo or something and threw it upstream from us, and everybody got amoebic dysentery.
Mm.
That's the only time I remember being sick while I was over there.
How long did that last?
Oh, it lasted three, 4 days. And, I mean, it was pretty serious. Everybody was shitting all over themselves, and
mm-hmm.
It was just a mess. But, yeah, that was the only time I felt sick that I remember.
Mm-hmm. Any time when you were in Hotel Company or Lima Company, did you have any pets? Did the unit have any pets?
No.
Okay. Okay. Tell me about the relationships between the men as far as race issues. Did you ever witness anything like that?
No, not really. You know, like I said, ours was an all-volunteer unit.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't ever... I remember, like, when we would come back to some place secure.
Mm-hmm.
Like the blacks would hang around with the blacks, the whites would hang around with the whites,
mm-hmm.
and of course the Mexicans would all hang around. But it wasn't that we didn't all get along. I mean,
mm-hmm.
And I don't remember any, and maybe it's just my memory, I don't know, but I don't remember any serious issues
mm-hmm.
about that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Why don't we take a break for a minute, Bill?
Okay.
Okay, Bill, continuing now, why don't we pick up, you guys were along Highway 1 running operations out of there, and you said you were wounded in August 67.
Yeah.
What happened in that incident?
We were at the CAC unit number 6, which was like right between Fubai and Da Nang.
Mm-hmm.
And it was right outside, there's a mountain pass, a range of mountains that runs from the coast up, and we were kind of right at that pass,
mm-hmm.
and so we went out and we set up a ambush,
mm-hmm.
and it was unusual because it was a platoon-size ambush,
mm-hmm.
and they took mortars with us for some unknown reason. I have no idea why,
mm-hmm.
but we went out, and it was in that area. It was kind of more sandy and brush.
Mm-hmm.
and stuff like that. And so we went out off of Highway 1 a ways, and in the evening when we were out there, we set up a platoon-sized L-shaped ambush
mm-hmm.
along what looked like to be a fairly significant trail.
Mm-hmm.
Well, by that time, I was a radio man.
Mm-hmm.
And so myself and the lieutenant, the platoon sergeant,
mm-hmm.
and the one of the corpsmen for our platoon
mm-hmm.
set up as rear security for the ambush.
Okay.
And as we were set up that night, two VC came down a small trail,
mm-hmm.
and came back by our ambush. We opened up on them. Me and the lieutenant knocked one down. And I guess it was a squad or whatever started opening up on us. One of them threw a grenade into our position.
Okay.
Hit all four of us.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as the grenade went off, the platoon sergeant, Sergeant Mines, it went off real close to him.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I was kind of dazed. I guess just a concussion
mm-hmm.
had dazed me. And all I can remember was seeing him, like, just stand up. And he just came walking toward me.
Right.
And I mean, what, just a couple of steps,
mm-hmm.
but, and then all of a sudden he just fell down. And he was making this god-awful gurgling sound that I'll never forget.
Mm-hmm.
And what had happened was the shrapnel had hit him in the neck and laid his neck open.
Mm.
And, like, this blood was spurting out 15 feet from his neck. What a corpsman who was hit came over, you know, and we were all still a little bit groggy, but the corpsman was taking care of him.
Mm-hmm.
The corpsman had been hit in the back by shrapnel.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, man, he's losing so much blood, he don't stand a chance.
Mm-hmm.
And the corpsman had me hold the artery or whatever the hell it was shut, I guess, until he could clamp it off, because I was so freaking dazed, I didn't know what I was doing.
Were you holding it with your bare hands or with an instrument?
Yeah. No, with our hands. Okay. He was still trying to get to his instruments and stuff. But it was really serious. I didn't think he was going to live.
Right.
And Lieutenant had been hit. I was me and Corman were nothing was life threatening.
Mm-hmm.
I was hitting a knee and then a leg.
With shrapnel?
Yes.
Okay. Did you realize you had been hit, or did it take a few minutes?
Not at first, no. But, so he finally, I guess, got the bleeding stopped or whatever, or under control.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then, of course, they called in, like we called in Medevac immediately, which got there quick.
Mm-hmm.
And so we put him on, we put him in, well, as a matter of fact, all three of them, the lieutenant, the corpsman, and the Sergeant Mines all were put on the medevac helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And left.
What about you?
I stayed with the ambush. There was nothing serious. I mean, I was having a hard time walking and stuff, but,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it wasn't serious. It wasn't life-threatening or nothing.
Were you in any kind of pain?
I was still numb, I think.
Okay.
And so I stayed with the ambush.
Okay. Did you all remain in the position, or did you move?
No, after the medevac left and we policed everything up,
mm-hmm.
we moved the position.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, got hit again. A guy was shot seven times.
Seven times?
Yeah, about what? And I'm not sure if he was shot by the VC seven times, but he had a magazine in his pocket that a round hit and cooked it off.
Mm.
Cooked all the rounds of the magazine off.
Did he survive?
Both of them survived, as far as I knew.
The platoon sergeant the first time around did?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, somebody told me, and I didn't think he did.
Right.
Of course, like I said, we never heard from him again.
Mm-hmm.
But someone told me later on, one of the guys at the reunion, that later on his way back, mm-hmm. they had landed in Hawaii and they ran into him in Hawaii.
Okay.
So he apparently survived.
Mm-hmm.
And the other guy who had been hit, and he had been hit one round that went through his helmet. Corporal Reddy had been hit one round, went through his helmet, and then went around his head. It didn't go in his head, but it laid his head open.
Wow.
And then he had been shot in this magazine that he had in his flak jacket pocket.
Mm-hmm.
And it cooked off all the rounds and took out the whole underside of his arm.
Mm-hmm.
And plus, he had been shot, like, in both legs and his stomach, and
mm-hmm.
just a mess. But it took had to call the medevac back, because this happened within 25 minutes after the medevac Sergeant Mines.
Mm-hmm.
It took the medevac 45 minutes to get back to this guy.
Mm.
But, he was real calm.
Right.
And I don't know if it was shock or whatever, but...
Mm-hmm.
And so then, after they medevaced him, we stayed out there the rest of the night.
Mm-hmm.
And then made our way back to Highway 1 the next morning, and then they took me to Fubai and worked on me.
What did they do exactly to you?
Just sewed me up and, I left me lay off of, you know, I didn't have to go on anything for, like, I don't know, number of 3 or 4 days, whatever.
Mm-hmm. I assume that the shrapnel either was taken out of you then, or didn't actually enter and stay in you?
Well, I didn't think so until just a couple of weeks ago. I found out that there's still pieces in there.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you set off a metal detector?
No, I went to the VA, and I thought I was getting some arthritis or something because my knee was starting to act up, and so they thought it was arthritis too, but they finally x-rayed me and found three pieces of metal still in there.
Really?
So,
are they going to take it out?
I'm not going to let them if it ain't bothering me no more than this. It only bothers me if I sit for a long time or something. If I move around, don't bother me at all.
Okay.
So.
Okay. So you received stitches in your knee area and your leg?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And it laid you up for, what, 3 days or so?
For a few days. And I guess, I don't remember, but, you know, maybe when I got back, they didn't, I don't think I went on any patrols or stuff like that for a while.
Mm-hmm. Were you able to be fairly mobile?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I have a stiff leg, and it was kind of wrapped up and stuff. But yeah, I could get around if I needed to.
Okay. Okay. Did this affect you at all psychologically? The fact that you've been wounded for the first time?
No, I don't think so.
Was there any kind of apprehension, you know, before you were ever shot or wounded, with the men in general about, you know, what it would feel like, what it would be like, how I would react to this?
Well, everybody was afraid of going back crippled.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, I think my worst fear was not, I thought about being killed.
Uh-huh.
I worried more about, I had seen guys with their legs blown off, I had seen, you know, guys hit in the eyes and, you know, various places, and I thought, I just don't want to go back crippled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So after you went through this ordeal and you got back to the unit, where did you go from there? Did you stay along Highway 1?
We stayed along Highway 1. Like I said, we were there approximately 2 to 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
So our company got built back up. And then they moved us up to, like, Camp Evans, which was north of Fubai.
Mm-hmm.
And we did the same thing in those areas up there. We ran around in the brush, just running. And we had minor incidents and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing real major.
Right.
And then they moved us up to Way City.
Okay.
At a place called the Rock Crusher.
The Rock Crusher.
Yeah, which was right outside the Citadel.
Mm-hmm. How different was it being in Way City than being, say, in
Fubai? It was real quiet. Now, this was like in, they moved us up there maybe in November, and I'm just guessing.
Uh-huh.
Maybe November of 67.
Uh-huh.
And we sprung a few small ambushes and stuff, but, I mean, mainly we didn't see very much outside of Way City.
Mm-hmm. How were the civilians? Did you ever get into Way, actually?
No.
Okay.
I didn't myself. I mean, we had drove through it on Highway 1.
Right.
Which went right through the middle of it.
Right.
But, I mean, as far as just being in there to walk around, no.
Okay. Okay. What was your mission there in Way?
We were just looking for any signs of the enemy or anything like that, and we found signs of large enemy units, but we never ran into any.
Okay.
We had one ambush that was out one night. There was like 9 of them out.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't with them, but 175 VC or MVA walked through their ambush.
Really?
Yeah.
That's quite a large number.
Yes. And, of course, they didn't open fire.
They did, yeah, because, yeah.
Because they'd never been heard from again.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, there was a very, you know, that was the only incident that I know of. But we had found signs of large units in that area.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that was right before Tet, when, and that was only a couple of months before Way City got overrun.
Right. I mean, you went from, you were in a very hot position that was going to get hotter, and then you actually went to Khe Sanh.
Yeah.
Which was just another hot.
We were there outside of Way City until, and I'm not sure the date, but it was January of 68 when they moved us to Khe Sanh.
And why did they move you to Khe Sanh? Did they explain anything to you?
They were bringing our whole regiment together at Khe Sanh.
Okay.
They knew that there was, you know, heavy activity up there, and they had found, you know, large units of NVA.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, regimental size and stuff units up there. So they brought our whole regiment together. Mm-hmm. Other battalions from the 26th Marines mm-hmm. had been up there earlier than us, mm-hmm. and they thought they needed to get more reinforcements up there because they were running into real large units, and there were signs of extensive NVA activity there.
Mm-hmm. How much communication was there about, you know, the overall plans of where and why your unit was being moved?
I don't remember.
With anything. You all on the ground, you know, with the basic infantry, with you guys.
I don't remember any. They just told us we had to move somewhere, and we moved.
Okay. Would your lieutenant explain exactly what was happening?
No.
Okay.
For one, I don't think he'd want to scare us, and for another, he, you know, probably the need wasn't there. He just had to have us do what we needed to do.
Right. Right. Okay. So when you moved to KSON, how did they take you over there?
I think we went by helicopter, but I'm not sure of that.
Okay. What did you know about KSON at the time?
Nothing really. It was just, I mean, we had operated around that area, you know, during Hickory and that,
mm-hmm.
between KSON and Contien there.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I really didn't know anything about KSON before that.
Okay.
There was nothing. I mean, they had the hill fight there.
Mm-hmm.
Some other units, you know, had operated, and they'd had some pretty big battles on 881
mm-hmm.
and stuff before we got there, but mm-hmm. I really didn't know anything about KSON.
Okay. Did you transfer? Is this when you transferred to Lima Company?
No, I didn't go to Lima Company until after I got back from Vietnam.
Okay, so you were a hotel the whole time?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me ask you a couple of general questions before we get into what happened at KSON.
Okay.
Can you describe Vietnam itself, the country? What were your impressions?
It was beautiful, but it was hot and nasty and stunk. And if you lived out in the jungle and stuff, it wasn't a nice place.
Mm-hmm. What did it smell like?
They cooked everything in this fish sauce. It's called Nook Bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And everything to me smelled like that.
Oh, really? Okay. What would you say was the most humorous event that you experienced over there?
Oh, geez, there were any number of them.
Uh-huh.
I guess I told you about the rock ape.
Yes.
And, there was just... We went out on ambush one night. We started getting ambushed. This guy, you know, everybody dropped to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And during all the shooting, he stands up. We're all wondering what the hell happened.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he fell down in a big pile of fresh buffalo shit.
Oh, God.
So he stands up. We're going, get the hell down.
Right.
You know, he's trying to wipe this stuff off of him.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there was times when... another time we were going out on an ambush, and they were bringing the water buffalo in.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the water buffalo hated the smell of us for some reason. There was something about us that the water... Them kids could ride on them, beat them and everything, and mm-hmm. the farmers used them, but as soon as they smelled us, they went nuts.
You mean the Americans or your unit?
The Americans.
Okay.
And we were going out one night, and it was just dusk, and they were bringing the water buffalo in, which they had to do every night.
Right.
And, of course... The water buffalo were trying to come in on the same trail we were trying to go out on.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, like, lined with bamboo.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they made their fences for their pens out of this bamboo.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the water buffalo, when they would see you, they would stop immediately. And then they'd start pawing the ground like they were going to charge.
Uh-huh.
Well, everybody broke off of the trail, when we broke off the trail, the water buffalo ran down while they turned into this pen.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the guys had broke through the bamboo, but was in their pen with them.
Uh-oh.
Of course, he managed to scramble out, but I think he ripped all his clothes off on that dirty attempt. There were just a million. There were a million things that I think were funny for us because everything was so serious. I think anything funny that happened was amplified.
Mm-hmm.
So... That's just a couple of incidents.
Okay. How about brave actions that you witnessed?
Oh, bunches.
What stands out in your mind when you think about that?
The corpsman running through the mortar attack on you know, during Hickory.
Yes, sir.
The corpsman and Marines just running out to pull their buddies back on 117.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just tremendous with all the stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
Just tremendous acts that, you know, no one ever heard about, and they don't even care to talk about, you know.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about going out under fire, pulling
out. Oh, yeah.
And these are, you're talking about corpsmen and just regular Marines going
oh,
out.
Oh, yeah.
Grabbing guys that they knew.
Oh, yeah. And just, you know, just unbelievable acts, but it was their buddies out there, so they were going to get them back.
Right.
So, it was just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, guys, as soon as the shooting would start, you know, guys running to be where the shooting's at so they could help out their friends.
Hmm. Kind of the opposite of what you would think as far as in the regular world.
Yeah,
you would...
worrying more about their buddies than any danger going on.
Right.
Just absolutely amazing. That's why everybody's so close-knit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anything else that stands out in your mind as far as brave action that you saw?
There were just countless times that happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you would think that people would be different.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, talk about how selfish and stuff people were, and you see that, you think, how unselfish can they be?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Has it changed since your time in Vietnam? Has it changed your view of humanity? Was it that powerful for you, or was that something very indigenous to the battlefield?
It's something indigenous to, yeah, our group, I guess. It's, you know, our group now, after all these years, even, you know, we didn't see each other for over 30 years, and yet we're so close.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something happens to you in a situation like that that is very powerful.
Right.
And so we're so close now, and I know now, and my wife Christy knows now, that if something happened, we could call these guys and they'd be here.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So.
Bill, let me break this for a second to change out this disc.
Okay.
Okay. Bill, what about yourself? Was there anything that you did in Vietnam as far as bravery, that you looking back at it, that you can label something in that category that you were surprised you did looking back?
I wasn't particularly brave, I don't think. But
was there anything that you did?
I just did what was what I thought was my job.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right?
And I guess that's the way everybody else felt about it too. But mm-hmm. Yeah, I wouldn't never talk about, I don't think, anything special.
Nothing that you did that you go, oh, my God, I can't believe I did that.
Well, I mean, there was incidents that happened, but I just wouldn't talk about that.
Okay. Did Hotel Company, did your unit ever engage in any kind of civic action for the villagers?
Yes.
What did you do?
We had a thing, that, like a market that the villagers would set up.
Mm-hmm.
And I know on a couple of occasions we would go out, we would set up a perimeter around the village.
Mm-hmm.
So that they could have their market without the VC coming in there and taking all their stuff away.
Did they realize you were doing that for them?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, you know, so they could sell their wares and stuff and
mm-hmm.
make their living for their families and that.
Mm-hmm.
And we did that on several occasions. I know we'd set up perimeters for engineers to come in and build things for them and
mm-hmm.
things like that.
Okay.
We gave them... Like I said, we gave the kids food and stuff whenever we could.
Mm-hmm.
Guys would give their own meals away to them.
Hmm. Did you ever work with any troops from other countries? Australia, New Zealand, South Koreans?
No, never directly.
Okay. All right. Bill, tell me about the tactics that your unit used in the field. You've talked about ambushes and patrols and, you know, setting up perimeters and taking the hill. How effective do you think these tactics were?
They were pretty effective.
And I'm talking also, you know, for the war that was on the ground in Vietnam in general. Do you think it was? Do you think they were having a positive impact upon the overall prosecution of the war, or do you think that the United States could have been instructing you all to do things differently?
Well, I mean, we were limited to what we could do,
mm-hmm.
and yeah, I mean, I don't think they could have stopped us from going anywhere we wanted to go.
They being the
NVA or the VC or that,
mm-hmm.
and. You know, I think if we'd have been turned loose, we could have done whatever needed to be done.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I mean, you know, that's the only thing. It was, since it was limited, we couldn't chase them across the border. We couldn't chase them into Laos or Cambodia or
mm-hmm.
anything. It was, for what we were allowed to do, the tactics we used were the best we could do.
Okay. Do you think, looking back, that the United States should have allowed you all to go across the borders and take care of business there?
You know, if it was up to us, we'd have rather got it over with.
Mm-hmm. Were you aware of that at the time, that it was kind of dragging on?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
You know, because we kept running into them in the same places and stuff. And
mm-hmm.
You know, we were aware that it was dragging on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But we felt we didn't have any say in it, so
right.
We just did what we had to do.
So what did you think of the anti-war movement back home? Because you're over there at a time when it's really heating up and it's going to get bigger. What was your impression, your thoughts?
We thought they were a bunch of idiots.
Mm-hmm.
You know? They weren't over there. I don't know. And you know, I don't think it bothered us so much that... them being against the war
mm-hmm.
is them being against the troops.
Right.
That's, you know, that was the part that I think bothered everybody more than anything. When we read in Stars and Stripes about them spitting on people and, you know, just being against the troops, you know, we just thought that was pitiful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What did you think of the media coverage of the war?
I thought it was pretty one-sided and pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
The only time I ever saw the media was, we had a lady, during Operation Hickory
mm-hmm.
that, was with our unit and golf company, but was in the area at the time. She,
mm-hmm.
as a matter of fact, she got wounded.
Really?
While she was up there,
mm-hmm.
and but she was the only one that I ever saw anywhere near any of the combat that we had,
mm-hmm.
and so I thought, how can these other people know and write these things without being there?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they're reporters, they should be out there finding out what really happened.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have a very good opinion of them.
At the time, you all were conscious of that. You didn't have a good opinion of them.
No.
Okay. In the anti-war movement, did it affect your morale at all over in the field?
Oh, I'm sure it had some effect.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure it did. I mean, but we didn't concentrate on that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, we didn't sit around and talk about that. We weren't too worried about what we were doing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So.
Okay. Bill, why don't we take a break and stop for the day?
That sounds like a good idea.
We're at
about wore out.
We're at a good stopping point, and we can pick up a case on when we come back, okay?
Okay.